And a great portent appeared in heaven, a woman clothed with the sun, with the moon under her feet, and on her head a crown of 12 stars. She was with child, and she cried out in her pangs of birth in anguish for delivery. And another portent appeared in heaven, behold, a great red dragon with 7 heads and 10 horns and 7 diadems upon his head. His tail swept down a third of the stars of heaven and cast them to the earth. And the dragon stood before the woman who was about to bear a child, that he might devour her child when she brought it forth. She brought forth a male child, one who is to rule all the nations with a rod of iron, but her child was caught up to God and to his throne. And the woman fled into the wilderness, where she has a place prepared by God in which to be nourished 1,260 days. The two signs that are the focal points here are the woman and the dragon. The woman is a symbol of what? She is a symbol of...
Mary is the new Eve as opposed to the old Eve.
Yes. Now there is a whole tradition of interpreting the woman as Mary, but
cosmologically,
I think is the way to go. And but again, one of the things that you know about cosmology in the Hebrew scriptures is that cosmology tends to be historicized. The myths are historicized. In the Hebrew scriptures, Zion is the mother, the woman, you see. So it is the people of God here. It is ideal representation. Therefore, she has these cosmic symbols about her, the sun and the moon, the stars in her crown. And it is from people that there arises what then? She is pregnant, but everybody knows she is pregnant with whom? The Messiah. This is the hope of Israel. The dragon is the foe God. And the dragon is immediately opposed to the Messiah. She was with child, and she cried out in her pangs of birth in anguish for delivery. And another sign, another portent appeared in heaven, behold, a great red dragon. Now notice the description: 7 heads, 10 horns, and 7 diadems upon his heads. What is that symbol? You can never draw that. But you can see that. And what do you see? What is this reminiscent of? Is reminiscent of the power and authority that is exercised by the Lamb. It is reminiscent of the power and the authority of God. What elicits the opposition of the dragon, and he already is starting to thrash about, his tail swept down a third of the stars of heaven and cast them to earth, and the dragon stood before the woman who was about to bear a child that he might devour her child when she brought it forth. Now, see, it is the Messiah whose birth triggers the enmity and opposition of the dragon. And I think that is the typical note that John strikes throughout these visions. Now, this male child is the Messiah, and he is to rule all the nations with a rod of iron. But her child was caught up to God and to his throne, and the woman fled into the wilderness, where she has a place prepared by God in which to be nourished for 1,260 days. Now, the woman is not a simple image. As Cease has already suggested, the woman is Zion. And the woman is the church. Notice how compressed the history of the Messiah is here. Birth and ascension. Now, what that is shorthand for the entire Christ event, just as you have shorthand in Paul when he talks of die and rise with Christ. That's shorthand for the entire Christ event. You know that old snake has no power, because the Messiah is caught up in the heaven.
Caught up in the heaven.
Caught up to God and to his throne. You see, the great red dragon with seven heads and 10 horns and 7 diadems upon his head, he does not participate in the power and authority of the throne of God. The Messiah exercises that authority and power. Now, just as Zion has been preserved and delivered from the dragon in the wilderness in the first Exodus, so the church in the second Exodus is preserved in the wilderness by God. And the time is fixed, you see. Yes. You know that there hasn't been any progression. This doesn't come after, but it is simultaneous. It is an intensification of the vision. It is a way of entering more deeply and more profoundly into what has already been revealed. Yeah, exactly. 3.5 years. A time and times and a half. Yeah, 3.5 years. Funny way to count, but you know. All of you have learned new math, so funny way to count is not anything strange. You see what John is doing, a very, very creative thing. If you read Beasley Murray, and I know you all read that with great care and pored over the details, you know that what John is working with is a myth that is known throughout the Hellenistic world. It is not a Hebrew myth, not a Roman myth, or a Greek myth, or an Assyrian myth, or an Egyptian myth. It is a kind of universal mythic pattern. It's an archetypal myth. And a part of that is the longing in human history for a Redeemer who will come forth and challenge the forces of evil, hold back the threat, and establish the golden age. You know? Now, what it seems to me that John is saying then is it's not simply the messianic hopes of Israel that are fulfilled in the land. Now, this is a breathtaking vision. Not simply the parochial and provincial hopes of the chosen people, but the universal aspiration of humanity. All of that is caught up and brought to fulfillment and consummation in the birth of Jesus, who is the Lamb, who exercised the authority and dominion and power of God. What a breathtaking vision that is. And to get bogged down in the details of the vision and miss what the vision really is proclaiming is a great tragedy. Now, you've got to pay attention to the details in order for the vision to function. But don't ever allow the tales to swallow you up. It's like singing a hymn and getting bogged down in the strange words. And they are strange, aren't they? But they are words that resonate in our subconscious. The old red dragon. People who write fantasies know that, don't they? Tolkien knows that, you know. So one of the reasons that stuff, nobody understands that. Huh? You read that? You don't read that? Huh? You want to read that? That's fun. You don't have to understand it. That's nice to read that and just be carried away. John is not speculating about mythology. John is using mythology to draw out the profound and universal and ultimate consequences of salvation history, namely the birth, the life, the death, the resurrection of Jesus of Nazareth. Mythology has been taken captive for the purpose of preaching the gospel. That's what he's doing, preaching the gospel. Now, your challenge is to find the myth, to find the way to do that. Now, one of the ways to do that is what we're doing. That is trying to recover the myth for ourselves, claim it for ourselves. It's one of the ways to do it. Not the only way to do it. Okay? See? Now, war arose in heaven. But I tell you, war in heaven is a way of interpreting the plague that comes through the birth of the Messiah in history. War in heaven. You don't get the war, you don't start with war in heaven. You see that? It starts with the birth of the new child.
what explodes.
Now war arose in heaven. Michael and his angels fighting against the dragon. And the dragon and his angels fought. But they were defeated. And there was no longer any place for them in heaven. Now, don't jump to conclusions too early about Michael and his angels. And the great dragon was thrown down, that ancient serpent. Aye, that's not nearly as good as that old snake. Who is called the devil and Satan, the deceiver of the whole world. He was thrown down to the earth, and his angels were thrown down with him. And I heard a loud voice in heaven saying, now the salvation and the power and the kingdom of our God and the authority of his Christ have come, for the accuser of our brethren has been thrown down, who accuses them day and night before our God. And they, now this is the point, have conquered him by the blood of the Lamb and by the word of their testimony, for they loved not their lives even unto death. Rejoice then, O heaven, and you that dwell therein, but woe to you, O earth and sea, for the devil has come down to you in great wrath, because he knows that his time is short. What is it that has overcome that old snake?
The lamb.
The lamb, you see. And that victory is entered into, it is participated in by those who love not their lives even unto death. They have conquered him not by their own courage, not by their own strength, but they have conquered him by participating in his death and resurrection. And they participate in his death and resurrection not in some spooky, mystical way, but by making a decision. Now, this is amazing. But every time the church in repentance and faith participates in the cross, the old snake is kicked out and the accuser is banished. Begin to feel sorry for that old snake. Rejoice then, O heaven, and you that dwell therein. You already see the contrast, don't you? The heaven dwells, and who are the ones that are in trouble? Woe to you, O earth and sea, for the devil has come down to you in great wrath, because he knows that his time is short. Now, the devil doesn't have any realm of operation except as persons decide to be what? That old snake can't do anything except when you decide to be an earth lover. Whoa. Whoa. All right. What has happened instead of that old snake standing before the throne of God and accusing the people of God, who stands now? The Lamb. And I'm stuck. All of it begins. We have an advocate.
You see,
in place of an accuser, we have an advocate. The advocate is the Lamb. See, John is not concerned about mythological speculation. He is concerned about the faith of the church now. And when the dragon saw that he had been thrown down to the earth, he pursued the woman who had borne the male child. Now, what does this mean? It means in the period between ascension and consummation, the church is tested. But the woman was given the two wings of the great eagle that she might fly from the serpent into the wilderness to the place where she is to be nourished for a time and times and half a time. See, the church is sustained in the wilderness by the grace of God. I was trying to think of that. There's a gospel song. What is the thing? Somebody help me. How did it go?
On the wings. What a wonderful song I am singing concerning the great speckled bird, how the people of God here are winging troubles from something of bird.
It's a great speckled bird. And then there's another one. The wings of a great white dove. That means the word helpful here because he refers to this imagery as the people of God in peril being borne to a place of refuge on wings of the eagle. Now, this is not any old eagle, I don't think. What does it say? What does the text say? The two wings of the great eagle, you see. It is a specific. It is not just any old bird. This is a great speckled bird, you see.
But the one that was flying around earlier back in chapter 4.
It could have been the whoa, eagle. you know see, just to indicate how that those images are torn out of context and perverted. There was a time in the Second World War when this was in England used as a prophecy of the buzz bomb. Remember the buzz bomb? The Germans built this piece of junk with a Maytag engine in it. And they would launch it from the channel ports, but they never knew where it was going to go. So it was a terrible, frightful thing, and it sounded like whoa, if you ever heard one of those things. And when it stopped whooing, you knew that you were in trouble. Get for cover, because it is coming down. As long as you could hear it, you were safe. But if it ever stopped, watch out. And so this was a prophecy of the buzz bomb. Whoom, whoom. Doesn't work. The serpent poured water like a river out of his mouth after the woman to sweep her away with the flood. And the earth came to the help of the woman, and the earth opened its mouth and swallowed the river which the dragon had poured from his mouth. Then the dragon was angry with the woman and went off to make war on the rest of her offspring, on those who keep the commandments of God and bear testimony to Jesus. And he stood on the sand of the sea. Again, it is the Exodus imagery that is critical. If you read the Hebrew scriptures, you will find a kind of recurring theme that the waters that are open and they come up out of this mythological framework that's being used here, and they are then employed in order to illuminate the historical situation of persecution, bondage that the people of God experience. And waters become the threat. And so when the waters are opened up, and the children of Israel, what they do, what's the hymn? They cross with unmoistened feet. Is that the way that is? Well, it's all rooted and grounded in this kind of imagery. Why unmoistened feet? I suspect that it's quite, if you were to try to get, there's nothing like that ever happened in history. But what it's really saying, that when you're delivered from bondage, it is God who frees you from bondage. You never get through the Red Sea because you're a good swimmer. You never get through the Red Sea because you're able to overcome Pharaoh. Pharaoh is an embodiment in history of Tiamat, Behemoth, Leviathan, Rahab, that old snake.
See?
And well, that's enough of that, I'm sure. Just as Messiah. Evokes, triggers the opposition of the dragon. Because of the Messiah's participation in the authority and power and dominion of God, so also the offspring of the woman, the Messianic people, because they keep the commandments of God and bear testimony to Jesus, are hated by, persecuted by, tracked down by the dragon. Stood on the sand on the sea. It is important to read this, it seems to me, not only as a part of the development of the book of Revelation, but to see that these images are interwoven into the gospel story. Why did Jesus teach beside the sea? Why does he call disciples beside the sea? Why does he walk on the sea? Why does he command the sea to be still?
These are all signs of conflict and war with the sea. That's all that the sea represents. And you simply have trivialized those texts when you read the pastoral scenes. Jesus gathering by the beautiful seashore. He is the victory in the war. And that's what these texts are saying. He is triumphant. I think you have to remember that this is not a dualistic system. Satan is no God. Satan comes under the sovereignty of God. So you need to write this way. God over here, too. There's nothing that happens over here that ever detracts from or happens at all except within the sovereignty of God.
That's the only place where they would get it.
That's exactly right. But they don't really have any authority at all. The authority that Satan exercises on earth is a parody of the authority of Christ. The authority of the Antichrist is a parody of Christ. Everything that is done with a false prophet is a parody of what the true prophets do.
But don't we give him the authority?
Sir?
We give it.
Oh, yes. He has no authority except that we allow that to happen. What is the function? Of that old, what is the function of that old snake? The deceiver of the whole world. His authority and power and dominion are a deceit and a lie. Seems to have power. If you look at this and the language suggests that Satan appears to have the power of God, right? That's the only reason that Satan could function. So that is based on deceit. The Antichrist seems to be Christ. Okay? The false prophets seem to be prophets. It is. Now, if you go back, and you should do this all the time, you should always be going back and reading the seven letters. And the seven letters, the basic and fundamental presupposition is that the greatest threat to the life of the churches in Asia is that they should tolerate, listen to, become followers of what? Yeah, but false prophets. See, false prophets serve the idol. And I saw a beast rising out of the sea with 10 horns and 7 heads, with 10 diadems upon its horns and a blasphemous name upon its head. And the beast that I saw was like a leopard, its feet were like a bear's, its mouth was like a lion's mouth, and to it the dragon gave his power and his throne and great authority. One of its heads seemed to have a mortal wound, but its mortal wound was healed, and the whole earth followed the beast with wonder. Men worshipped the dragon, for he had given his authority to the beast, and they worshipped the beast, saying, "Who is like the beast, and who can fight against it?" This is the Antichrist. And the Antichrist, it exercises the authority and power and dominion of the devil. He exercises deceit she exercises deceit. If we go to, it's very important that in the seven letters, Jezebel, if you're going to be liberated, enter into the full thing. You see here that it's exactly parallel. Christ exercises the authority of God. The Antichrist exercises the authority of that old snake. Right? The prophets, the true prophets, witness to and confirm the saving work of God revealed in Christ. False prophets witness to and confirm the work of the Antichrist. Now, what you really see is that the arena of the struggle is not what it is often described as. And I think it's practically impossible for us to get it out of our minds. We still talk about the purpose of John is to encourage the church to stand firm against the Roman Empire. You see? That is to historicize the prophecy, to limit its validity. It is to trivialize it. The purpose of John is to enable the church to see the difference between worshiping that old snake and worshiping God. And the place where the issue is drawn is in the church. If you want to read the text with insight and with immediate relevance for our situation, don't read it trying to identify the Antichrist with some historical reality of the contemporary situation. If you do that, you almost guarantee that it's not going to have any validity at all for you. But read it. Try and see how that in the institution and the tradition of the Christian church, Christ has become the Antichrist. Tune your ear to hear the preaching of Christ, which is really the gospel of the devil. That's the reason, you know, why would John say that the key is discernment? Tune your ear, the ear, and discern between prophet and false prophet. In the church. When does the Antichrist take over? When the people of God are deceived. When do the people of God become earth dwellers? When they're deceived. What is the function of false prophet? Deceit. Men worship the dragon, for he had given his authority to the beast, and they worshiped the beast, saying, who is like the beast, and who can fight against it? That is the blasphemy, you see. The blasphemous name, it's too cheap a shot to say the blasphemous name is Caesar Augustus. It is too cheap a shot to say the blasphemous name is Nero. Who is like the beast? Who can fight against it? You know, that is the motto of triumphalism in the church. That's what that is. Who can compare with Methodism? What marvelous doctrine. And what splendid administrative structure. What is power? Who can fight against it? Who is like the beast? See, there's nothing as marvelous as triumphalism. Well, this may be wrong. I tell you, wrong in the right direction. Now, you were asking me about the heads, crowns, and so forth. And it's not the number. It's the fact that the Antichrist exercises the authority and power of that old snake. That's it.
You sure this isn't intended to say that he has more?
Well,
I don't want to get bogged down with numbers.
Yeah, sure. But you would be operating in the right direction then. Mm-hmm. You're not trying to make some historical
identity. What does stand for? Right.
Yeah, sure.
No. You don't get friends.
See, Antichrist is a corruption of Christ. There would be no Antichrist if there were not Christ. You understand that? And who creates Antichrist? Who gives Antichrist any validity, any viability? We do. You puzzle sometimes. You wonder why the Book of Revelation is read. You understand now why it is read. It isn't read for the same reason that the other parts of the Scripture are not read. The Scripture is not read because it is a torment. You cannot hear it.
It's important, I think, to go back and read the creedal statements in the Hebrew Scriptures that have to do with the deliverance of Israel from Egyptian bondage. It's also important to read the Psalms with an eye to how this imagery is picked up in the Psalms, and the images become a part of the personal and corporate piety of the people of God. So this dragon has a lot of history. it is rich with meaning. The names that are given to the dragon are tremendously important: Behemoth and Leviathan, Rahab. And then to know that this is a myth that was current throughout the ancient world, Egypt, Assyria, Greece, Rome, all have their particular expression of this myth. So when John takes it up here and begins to relate it to the redemption that the church experiences through the Lamb, I think he is deliberately
associating the Christian hope and the Christian realization of salvation with a hope that is universal. And it is a means whereby the particularity of the event of the cross is given a kind of universal reference. It's similar to, but of course different, but similar to the way the Logos Christology is developed in the prologue to the Gospel of John. The conflict that unfolds, you see, is a conflict that has a kind of unity to it because of the solidarity of the dragon and the sea beast and the earth beast. And then as that combat unfolds, as it starts off in heaven, and as it begins to find its expression on earth, the combat becomes much more subtle and internalized, you see. The pressure for decision is accentuated, and the pressure that the church experiences in this conflict is intensified, and the material intends to help one to enter more fully into that struggle. And one of the ways that it does that is by interspersing periodically in the material specific calls that are directed to the church, challenges to the church for decision. And you might want to get these identified here so that as we go through the material, when you come upon them, you will realize where you are. That helps, doesn't it, if you know where you are in relationship to the development of the narrative. Now, in the 12th chapter, 12, 10, and 11, and I heard a loud voice in heaven saying, "Now the salvation and the power and the kingdom of our God and the authority of his Christ have come, for the accuser of our brethren has been thrown down, who accuses them day and night before our God, and they have conquered him by the blood of the Lamb and by the word of their testimony, for they loved not their lives even unto death." Now, you see what has happened there. This is a historicizing of the conflict. It has to do with the response of people on earth. It's no longer this mythological picture. Then the next verse, 12:12, is a direct address to those that are involved in the struggle. "Rejoice then, O heaven, and you that dwell therein. But woe to you, O earth and sea, for the devil has come down to you in great wrath, because he knows that his time is short." Now, I think there is a deliberate reference to those you that dwell therein. The heaven dwellers and the earth dwellers are two groups, and a decision about authority, a decision about kingdom and power, is the kind of decision which determines whether one is in fact an earth dweller or a heaven dweller. Now in the 13th chapter, just so you'll be alert to these as they come up. 9 and 10. And you can't miss this because the text calls for your attention. If anyone has an ear, let him hear. You see, that is the word that recurs as a motif in the seven letters. So if anyone has an ear, let him hear. Now, if anyone is to be taken captive to captivity, he goes. If anyone slays with the sword must he be slain. And then the straight out identification. Here is a call for the endurance and faith of the saints. The text intends to enable endurance and faith. And that is a specific challenge that is directed to the church in the age, seems to me. And then if you drop down to the end of that chapter 13:8. And the words just leap out of the text. This calls for wisdom. Wisdom on the part of who? On the part of the church. This calls for wisdom. Let him who has understanding reckon the number of the beast. For it is a human number. Its number is 666. And then turn over to 14, 4 and 5. It is these who have not defiled themselves with women, for they are chaste. It is these who follow the Lamb wherever he goes. These have been redeemed from mankind as first fruits for God and the Lamb, and in their mouth no lie was found, for they are spotless. And he said with a loud voice, fear God and give him glory, for the hour of his judgment has come, and worship him who made heaven and earth, the sea, and the fountains of water. The issue throughout this battle is really the central issue, who is worthy? Who is worthy? God, the Lamb, and those who worship the Lamb are worthy. 14:9 and 11. If anyone worships the beast and its image and receives a mark on his forehead or on his hand, he also shall drink the wine of God's wrath, poured unmixed into the cup of his anger, and he shall be tormented with fire and brimstone in the presence of the holy angels and in the presence of the Lamb. And the smoke of their torment goes up forever and ever. They have no rest day or night, these worshippers of the beast and its image, and whoever receives the mark of its name. Notice how the text then directs attention to the decision. In 12, here is a call for the endurance of the saints, those who keep the commandments of God and the faith of Jesus. 14:13. And I heard a voice from heaven saying, write this, blessed are the dead who die in the Lord henceforth. Blessed indeed,
says the Spirit, that they may rest from their labors, for their deeds follow them. The contrast between the torment of the earth dwellers and the blessedness of the heaven dwellers is dramatic, and it is intended, and it is intended to be the occasion for decision. 15:3-4. And this is really the climax of the entire section. Great and wonderful are thy deeds, O Lord God the Almighty. Just and true are thy ways, O King of the ages. Who shall not fear and glorify thy name, O Lord? For thou alone art holy. All nations shall come and worship thee, for thy judgments have been revealed. And that comes as the climax. And again, it is the eternal dominion of God. Is the everlasting sovereignty of God set over against the defeat of the dragon, defeat of the sea beast and the earth beast and all the earth dwellers. So that's the kind of pattern that you find in this section. And my own judgment is that these passages that we've gone through are the passages where John intends the attention of the hearer to focus. Now then, to begin then with 13:1. And I saw a beast rising out of the sea, with 10 horns and 7 heads, with 10 diadems upon its horns, and a blasphemous name upon its head. And the beast that I saw was like a leopard, its feet were like a bear, and its mouth was like a lion's mouth. And to it the dragon gave his power and his throne and great authority. One of its heads seemed to have a mortal wound, but its mortal wound was healed, and the whole earth followed the beast with wonder. Men worshiped the dragon, for he had given his authority to the beast, and they worshiped the beast, saying, "Who is like the beast, and who can fight against it?" Now, the sea beast, of course, is a symbol of the Antichrist. And one of the reasons that this imagery is so powerful is that the Antichrist is a parody of Christ. The Antichrist has power and authority, and it comes from the sea. Now the sea, as we have already pointed out, is the dwelling place of the dragon. The sea is a symbol of death and destruction. The sea beast has all the trappings of great power and authority. It has solidarity with the dragon. Notice, the dragon gave his power and his throne
and great authority to the sea beast. The sea beast has the appearance of indestructibility. It seems to be invincible. That is, even when it is mortally wounded, it comes back again. Now, you know from reading the commentaries that this is a reference to a myth that circulated in the Roman Empire about Nero Redivivus. And the myth about Nero was much more terrible than the reality of Nero, you see. It is the myth about Nero that strikes terror in the hearts of men and women. The dragon is worshipped in the shape of the beast, so that the beast claims for the dragon and for himself or herself, you know, I don't know exactly what the sex is here, but claims for itself the absolute loyalty and allegiance which belongs only to God. Now, so they worship the beast, saying, who is like the beast and who can fight against it? Now, the reason that the sea beast has such seductive power is that the sea beast claims for the kingdom of evil the allegiance which belongs to God and the Lamb. Who is worthy? From the standpoint of the corruption of the earth, the answer is the beast and dragon. Who can resist the beast and the dragon? No one. It has invincible power. And that's the picture that is painted here. Even when it seems to be defeated, it returns miraculously to exercise its seductive power in human history. Now you see then that what you have here is God becomes a parody of the Lamb. And you, if you are alert to this, then you begin to experience something of the power of the images that John is employing. And the beast was given a mouth, uttering haughty and blasphemous words,
and it was allowed to exercise authority for 42 months. It opened its mouth to utter blasphemies against God, blaspheming his name and his dwelling, that is, those who dwell in heaven. Also, it was allowed to make war on the saints and to conquer them. And authority was given it over every tribe and people and tongue and nation, and all who dwell on earth will worship it. Everyone whose name has not been written before the foundation of the world in the book of life of the Lamb that was slain. If anyone has an ear, let him hear. If anyone is to be taken captive, to captivity he goes. If anyone slays with the sword must he be slain. Here is a call for the endurance and faith of the saints. Now, the Lamb, if you remember the picture, the basic weapon of the Lamb is the Word. The sword issuing from the mouth of the Lamb. You remember that? The sea beast in the service of the dragon carries on a ministry of the Word. The arena for this is the church. And there is no escaping. Unless you leap outside and begin to do what has been done, I think, over and over again with the text, that is to use it to objectify the enemy. Absolutize the evil. And then justify the church as becoming what it was never intended to be. That is, a competing institution in the world of institutions, where it simply struggled for survival over against other institutions. Notice here that the authority on this side is absolute, and the authority over here is conditioned. This line is a deceptive line. See, you should write God across the whole thing, because the dragon exercises no authority except under the sovereignty of God. There is no ontological or metaphysical dualism in the revelation. It was allowed. And who does the allowing? God does. It was allowed to make war on the saints and to conquer them. Authority was given it over every tongue and people, every tribe and people and tongue and nation, and all who dwell on earth will worship it. Everyone, then, whose name has not been written before the foundation of the world in the book of life of the Lamb that was slain. The only thing that will
preserve the church in its purity is what God has done in the Lamb, in the Word of the Lamb. And what God has done in the Lamb is a symbol of what God has always done. There has never been a time when God has not been Lamb-like before the foundation of the world. Primordial reality is the reality of the throne of God and the Lamb who shares the throne of God. Now, if anyone has an ear, let her hear. If anyone is to be taken captive, to captivity he goes. See, the deliverance of the church in this hour of trial is not some miraculous rescue. Those who take the church captive exercise the power to do that. And it is not the call of the prophet to the church to resist the world in terms of the world's power. And so it goes on to make it very clear. If anyone slays with the sword must he be slain. Here is a call for the endurance and faith of the saints. The church endures. It is given faith because of the Lamb and the Word that makes the passion of the Lamb available to the church at the particular moment of crisis. Here is a call for the endurance and faith of the saints. That's so much for the sea beast. Sea beast, of course, is Antichrist. What is the saving purpose of God? What is God about? Who's ruined anything? How does this all start? I'm talking about now this section. Just pay attention to the section. Who begins the problem? Who starts this mess? The combat.
Well, the dragon.
The dragon. Where is the old snake? Where does the old snake have power?
When we give it power.
Huh?
When we give it power.
Oh.
Now we're the ones allowing that. So aren't we the transmitters of the authority?
Sure. I mean, deceit. Deceit. In the next section, the great word is going to come up here. And it needs to be put down here now, but it probably ought to be put at the top. Deceit. Reality, truth, a lie. Well, that's the reason that John uses such realistic language. He doesn't intend to say that the bondage
the destruction, the corruption, the ruination that comes because of this parody is not real. It is real indeed. But it is real. In terms of our history, what is being said, as I understand that, is that what seems to be real, and what seems to be triumphant, and what seems to be everlasting, has come to an end in that event. Namely, that the power of death, the power of violence, the power of hatred, the power of claiming for itself, blasphemy, all of that is finished. It is done in that word, or the word of the prophet. What is the word of the prophet? The word of the prophet is the reading of history in the light of God's work in the land. When that word is corrupted, there is no way that those who hear that corrupt word are going to be rooted and grounded in the reality of that. So their lives are rooted and grounded in the lie, and they are ruined. And if it is the case, and I think it is in John, that the Lamb is the prototype of the heaven dwellers. So what God has done in the Lamb is what God intends to do in all creation through the Lamb. But God does not do it except in the Lamb. And if that is true, then it is always essential to what God does to have a place for saying no. And what John is saying is that that is the way the world was created, and that is the way the world is consummated. There is no other power. John is saying that you're always on that slippery place. And it is the word that enables you to stand, to endure, to be faithful, to dwell in heaven rather than to dwell on earth. Here's a call for the endurance and faith of the saints. The the next image is that of the beast which rises out of the earth. Then I saw another beast which rose out of the earth. It had two horns like a lamb, and it spoke like a dragon. It exercises all the authority of the first beast in its presence, and makes the earth and its inhabitants worship the first beast whose mortal wound was healed. It works great signs, even making fire come down from heaven to earth in the sight of men. And by the signs which it is allowed to work in the presence of the beast, it deceives those who dwell on earth, bidding them make an image for the beast which was wounded by the sword and yet lived. And it was allowed to give breath to the image of the beast, so that the image of the beast should even speak, and to cause those who would not worship the image of the beast to be slain. Also it causes all, both small and great, both rich and poor, both free and slave, to be marked
on the right hand or the forehead, so that no one can buy or sell unless he has the mark, that is, the name of the beast or the number of its name. This calls for wisdom. Let him who has understanding reckon the number of the beast, for it is a human number. Its number is 666. That's enough to strike terror in your little cool heart. The Lamb is represented on earth, and the witness to the Lamb is the prophet, and you have to see this over against the two prophets that are presented in the 11th chapter. So here you have prophets, and you fill out this chain over here with the false prophets. This is done very skillfully. Then I saw another beast which rose out of the earth. It had two horns like a lamb, and it spoke like a dragon. That is, it has the appearance of the lamb, but it has the message of the dragon. Jezebel, Balaam, the Nicolaitans, teaching, false prophets. It exercises all the authority of the first beast in its presence and makes the earth and its inhabitants worship the first beast whose mortal wound was healed. Now, this is a kind of liturgical reinforcement of the Antichrist. The religious dimension of this whole scene of corruption is being underscored. It exercises all of the authority of the first beast in its presence and makes the earth and its inhabitants worship the first beast whose mortal wound was healed. See, there is coercion, tyranny, violence, as over against the freedom of the worship of God. See, it is no accident here that the verb is makes the earth and its inhabitants worship the first beast whose mortal wound was healed. And the 13th verse is a critical verse in the development of this whole section. It works great signs, even making fire come down from heaven to earth in the sight of men. Now, we'll go back later on and look at that in detail, but the verse that must be, I think, paired with this is 11:5. And if anyone would harm them, fire pours from their mouth and consumes their foes. If anyone would harm them, thus he is doomed to be killed. That is the way two lamps stand, witness to the power and presence of God in Sodom, Egypt, Jerusalem. And by the signs which it is allowed to work in the presence of the beast, it deceives those who dwell on earth. See, the power of the earth beast and the sea beast is the power of deceit. It is the power of the lie. It deceives those who dwell on earth, bidding them make an image for the beast which was wounded by the sword and yet lived. And it was allowed to give breath to the image of the beast, so that the image of the beast should even speak, and to cause those who would not worship the image of the beast to be slain. Now, I don't suppose the text had in mind what happens in programs of evangelism and church growth, but the text is immediately applicable. This is a report of the success of coercion. Religious success. Also, it causes all, both small and great, both rich and poor, both free and slave, to be marked on the right hand of the forehead. There is the triumphalism of the lie. And it's all done in the name of transcendence. Don't forget that, you see. So that no one can buy or sell unless he has the mark, that is, the name of the beast or the number of its name. Now, just as the victory of the children of the woman is assured by their having their names written in the book of life, they have a new name, they have a solidarity, you see, with the prophets, the Lamb, and God, and that solidarity is symbolized by their name. So there is a community, there is a kingdom of the lie. The solidarity of those who live by the lie. The camaraderie. Common interest.